Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
What rhubarb, senna, or what purgative drug will scour these English hens? Now that's the line, spoken by Macbeth in Shakespeare's Scottish play, that in May 1849 contributed to one of the worst riots in the history of New York City, the Astor Place riot of 1849. Tom Holland, are you familiar with the Astor Place riot?
This is a riot about...
About Macbeth.
No.
Yeah, this is a bizarre but true story. So... Mid-19th century America, all sorts of sort of nativist passions and so on, anti-English passions. And there's this great row in New York between the supporters of two actors, Edwin Forrest, who's the sort of all-American hero, and William Charles Macready, who is batting for Britain, and the great crowds who cheer their man on, who think that their man is better at Shakespeare, better at playing Macbeth.
That's a great reason to have a riot. I mean, you've got to have a riot.
You know what they shouted? You know what they shouted?
No.
From the stalls, down with the codfish aristocracy. I think that's a kind of anti-English line of some kind. So our subject is the Scottish play.
It is.
Which has inspired passions down the ages.
And rumours of curses and all kinds of things.
Curses, witches.
Well, actually, you know the reason I really wanted to do this was because the Almeida Theatre in London, which is my favourite theatre.
Favourite theatre? You have a favourite theatre?
I do have a favourite theatre. And they were due to kick off with a performance of Macbeth today with Saoirse Ronan as Lady Macbeth. And I had tickets. And it's just been cancelled because of
COVID.
Because of a COVID outbreak. Oh. I mean, the whole play hasn't, but the tickets that I had have been cancelled. So
that's very sad.
So
I should
that is
say
a shame.
To the listeners, this is a very unusual, podcast, isn't it?
It is.
We're actually for once in the same room.
It is.
Which is a bit weird.
So we're really taking a punt here because obviously we're doing it on Macbeth, which is incredibly unlucky. So something awful is clearly going to happen over the course of recording this podcast. But also we're having to adjust to actually kind of looking at each other.
It's very disconcerting, actually, because we're kind of sitting side by side talking to each other in a way that you just...
I've completely forgotten how to do.
Yeah, you just wouldn't sit like this in real life, would you?
No.
I mean, not that this is not real life, but... No.
So, Macbeth. But the other reason I wanted to do it is because I think that the historical figure of Macbeth, which lies behind the kind of bloodstained tyrant of Shakespeare's play, he wasn't at all a bloodstained tyrant. He was actually a pretty good king. I mean, he was such a good king that in the 11th century, he was able to go on pilgrimage to Rome, which is kind of the measure of how well your kingdom is doing.
And he could leave it behind him.
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, how and why mm-hmm. did this very effective, really quite popular king become, you know, this kind of byword for tyranny?
Yeah.
And the answer to that question, I propose, goes to the heart of the making of Scotland.
Okay.
So the fashioning of Scotland out of the various constituent parts that make it up.
Okay, so before we get into that, I'll just say for the listeners, we will talk about the play. Tom mentioned very ominously that he thought we might get halfway through and he would have got to Macbeth's birth, which I think is bad planning. But we're going to get to the play probably in the second half, and we'll talk about the witches, we'll talk about James the First, we'll talk about the Shakespearean
curse.
Context, the curse, and a couple of notable productions of Macbeth. But first, Tom sent me a message yesterday saying that he had gone down a rabbit hole of Scottish medieval politics, and I want to see him clamber.
Well,
out.
Yeah. So obviously all early medieval history is incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
A, because the sources are often very sparse.
Yeah.
And B, because they're often overwritten by people who have a kind of set interest in rewriting them.
Yes.
So it's very difficult and complex. And I think, I put my hand up that I know the history of early medieval England much better than I do the history of early medieval Scotland. And there's a similar process by which kind of fragmentary kingdoms start to cohere
Okay.
And then...
Like Wessex and Mercia in England.
Exactly, become England. So a similar process happens in Scotland, but it's more complicated in Scotland, because in Scotland you have people speaking basically different languages. So to be very, very reductive,
yeah.
If you think of Scotland, you think of the Lowlands and the Highlands, and then you quarter it.
Mm-hmm.
So the southeast corner, Lothian, up to the Firth of Forth, is basically a part of the Kingdom of Northumbria, which is English-speaking. And so the borough in Edinburgh reflects...
Oh, right.
You know, it's like a kind of the burr
yes.
that Anglo-Saxon kings build. Yeah. They're kind of fortified marketplaces. So that's
and Middlesbrough.
Yeah, and so Edinburgh was for a long a kind of Northumbrian stronghold. Then you think of the southwest, so Strathclyde.
That's Strathclyde, right.
And that is it's a Welsh-speaking kingdom with the great rock of Dumbarton.
Yeah.
Alt Clwt, the rock of the Clyde.
Yeah.
Incredibly romantic. Then the northeast of the Highlands, you've got a kind of great mountain range going through the middle, kind of separating the Highlands. On one side, the western side of that,
mm-hmm.
you've got the Kingdom of Dalriada, which is Gaelic speaking,
yeah.
and has very, very strong links to Northern Ireland. And then on the other side, you have this mysterious people who the Romans knew as Picts.
Yeah.
And in due course, the Picts come to call themselves Picts. They
I
kind of appropriate
this from 1066
this.
And all that.
Absolutely. The Picts and the Scots. So the Scots. Is the name that the people of Dalriada apply to themselves. But the complexity here is that the Scotti were originally Irish.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that from 1066.
So that's also very complicated. And they derive their name from Scotta. Do you know who Scotta was?
No.
She was the Egyptian princess who discovered Moses and the bulrushes. And she is
that's
then...
Very,
it's unexpected. Yeah. Unexpected. So she is then supposed to have travelled to Ireland...
Yeah.
And established this royal line.
Unlikely, I would say.
Implausible, as your father would say.
Yeah.
So the kings of Dalriada claim a line of descent from the Irish or Scots.
From ancient Egypt?
Ultimately from ancient Egypt, because it's a marker of class. Now, in fact, this is not true, or at least the archaeological evidence suggests it's not true. So there are kind of tales of the Irish... colonising Dalriada.
Right.
But there is no archaeological evidence for this
just
whatsoever.
Say, you were right. You have gone down a rabbit hole.
I know. But this is all complicated because it's all about basically kind of kings manufacturing backstories for themselves.
So which bit is Macbeth from?
Okay. So we'll come to that.
Okay.
But just keep in mind that you've got the Picts,
yeah.
you've got the Scots...
Yeah.
Then you've got the British, the Welsh-speaking Britons of Strathclyde, and then you've got the English of Northumbria.
Okay.
And this is the kind of stasis that exists until the Vikings arrive. And as in England,
yeah.
when the Vikings come, they smash up all the kingdoms, and it provides scope for the West Saxon kings in the long run to kind of pick up all the rubble, fashion it together, and construct a new kingdom, the new Kingdom of England.
Yes.
The same process basically happens... when the Vikings attack, because they smash up Northumbria, as you'll know from Bernard Cornwall.
Yes.
And basically Bamburgh is the kind of only survivor. It's kind of semi-independent. They attack and sack the fortress of Dumbarton. So the kingdom of the Britons is, I mean, it's patched together, but it's a shadow of its former self.
That's Strathclyde, isn't it? Yes.
And there's a battle in which an alliance of the Dalriadans, so the Scottish... and the Pictish kings are attacked by the Vikings
yeah.
and kill both the kings of Pictland and Dalriada. And I was reading A History of Early Medieval Scotland, and it's absolutely classic kind of sentence of the kind that you get in Histories of Early Medieval Scotland. And it said, this is one of the most decisive battles in British history. However, we have no idea when it was fought or where,
right.
or who was killed.
Yeah,
in it.
So we don't even know
the names of the kings.
Right.
But basically,
it's a great story.
So all of these kingdoms either get kind of smashed to pieces or decapitated.
Yeah.
And out of this carnage,
yeah.
there emerges a shadowy figure.
Please tell me this is Macbeth.
No, it's a guy called Kinnaid MacAlpin. who is commemorated as Kenneth MacAlpin.
Yeah.
And this inaugurates a wave of people called Kenneth and Malcolm.
It does. We're hundreds of years away from Macbeth at this point, right?
Yeah, so we're about 870. So we're about 100 years, about 120 years from his birth.
Okay.
But we're getting there. We're getting there. Because the thing about Kenneth MacAlpin is that he establishes a line of kings. But also, he seems to have fused the Dalriada and the Pictish traditions. So people debate whether he was a Pict who spoke Gaelic, whether he was a Gael who kind of had married into the Picts. I mean, it's unconfusing. Right. But basically, he's able to...
So he's either a Pict who spoke Gaelic or a Gael who spoke Pictish.
Well, he doesn't speak Pictish.
Okay.
He definitely doesn't speak Pictish because the significant thing that happens is that over the course of the century that follows, Pictish starts to vanish.
Okay, let's not get into Pictish.
No, I know, but the tradition that comes to be told is that the Gaels had conquered the Picts and kind of wiped them out, which is why Pictish. Again, this is a kind of back projection of what seems to happen, which is that there is a kind of pooling of Pictish and Dalriadan identities and interests. The kings who follow Kenneth MacAlpine, most of whom are called either Malcolm or Kenneth, very very confusingly. They're able to establish this kind of kingdom that combines the best of the Pictish and the Scottish traditions. But because it's Gaelic speaking, it comes to be known as Alba, which is the Gaelic for the whole of Great Britain. But it comes to be particularly associated,
presumably related to Albion.
Yes. So initially, so it's Alba is the kind of Gaelic version of Albion.
Yeah.
But the kingdom of Alba comes to be this Dalriadan Pictish. So that's what's going on. Then over the course of the 9th century, obviously you have the English state emerging and becoming increasingly powerful. Mm-hmm. So you have Athelstan, for instance, who launches an invasion to impose English supremacy on it.
And becomes Emperor of all Britain.
Emperor of all Britain. But his successors discover that they can't basically keep a hold on the northern reaches. I mean, not just of Britain full stop, but of, the northern reaches of Northumbria.
Yeah.
And so basically the Scottish king starts to kind of annex them, but it's all very incoherent. It's inchoate. It's not entirely clear this is not in any way stable.
Yeah.
And a crucial complication here, which is a kind of gap in the sources. And so it's quite hard. It's like kind of looking for a black hole, is the uppermost reaches of what had been Pict land. So what is now kind of Inverness, Murrayforth, that kind of region. So this had been a Pictish kingdom called Fortriu.
Right, as if we need another kingdom.
And it reemerges about 150 years later as the kingdom of Moray.
And that's Macbeth's kingdom, right?
That is Macbeth's kingdom.
Okay, so I can see Macbeth at the end. We're in a massive tunnel, but I can just about make Macbeth out at the end of it.
So the two aspects of Scotland when Macbeth is born in about 1000 AD that have to be borne in mind, which are subsequently kind of overwritten and reconfigured, are firstly, the Kingdom of Alba of Scotland does not yet correspond to Scotland as it is now, because the Kingdom of Moray, it's a co-kingdom, it's a kind of sub-kingdom, but it's not entirely absorbed into the Kingdom of Scotland.
And it's mainly in the Highlands?
So it's around Inverness.
Yeah.
Cawdor.
Okay, so all, of Cawdor,
yes, so all these kind of places.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that the line of succession from Kenneth MacAlpin is incredibly confusing. And I'm aware that everything I've said up till now is confusing.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping the listeners won't be running off howling, their eyeballs dropping out at all this.
But there is
no single accepted line of succession from it, because under Scottish law, Gaelic law, descendants of the great grandfather can inherit the throne. So that means, in effect, that Kenneth MacAlpin had two sons, so there are two lines of succession, and they basically kind of alternate.
So there's no kind of primogeniture. Are you elected by a group of nobles? How's it work?
Yeah, basically.
Right.
Basically, yes, I mean, if you're an atheling, to put it in the kind of English terms,
Anglo-Saxon terms,
you are kind of worthy to inherit, and that depends partly on whether you have the right line of descent. It's partly whether you're of military age. It's partly your record. It's partly your marriage. It's partly how many kind of backers you have. So we have
a question about this, Tom.
Yeah.
we can drag this back towards the questions that the listeners sent in. SHSK English says, Was it usual for Scottish kings to name their successors as Duncan names Malcolm?
No.
Right.
Okay. So, it's not usual. And this kind of plunges us into the key about what's happening with Macbeth and why he's such a significant figure for subsequent Scottish history.
Great.
So, early 11th century.
Yeah.
The age of Canute.
Yes.
Great, you know.
So England, Danish is, king. England's focus is kind of the North Sea Empire, isn't it, of Canute and all that stuff.
Yes. 1005,
yeah.
You have one of these classic events of early medieval Scotland when Kenneth, the son of Malcolm, is killed by Malcolm, the son of Kenneth.
That's
brilliant. So Malcolm, the son of Kenneth, becomes Malcolm the Second.
Right.
And he's the King of Scotland.
Yep.
He's a very effective player, but his first...
So the King of Scotland, this is not Moray.
No, he's the King of Scotland. Moray is still part. We'll come to Moray in a minute.
Okay.
But we need to get Malcolm the Second.
So he's the King of the rest of Scotland?
Yes, basically.
Right.
Well, he's the King of Scotland, because Moray is not yet a part of Scotland.
Yeah, okay, fine.
It's kind of complicated, yeah, but you've just got to keep in your mind that...
There is no Scotland.
Yes, it doesn't correspond to Scotland as it is now.
Yep.
So 1006,
yep.
He attacks Northumbria.
Okay. I was dreading you were going to say Kenneth, the son of Malcolm.
No, he attacks Northumbria and he gets defeated by, I think it's the son or the nephew of the Northumbrian Earl. And do you know what he's called?
Kenneth.
No, he's called Uhtred.
Oh, Uhtred. Very nice.
All fans like of Bertrand Cornwall. Yeah.
Very good.
The Scots army gets wiped out. All the nobles get, they get beheaded. Their heads get taken to the women of Bamburgh who braid their hair.
Oh, nice.
And then each woman who braids the hair of a severed head gets a cow for her work from Uhtred. And then they're stuck on spikes around Bamburgh and Durham.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of great victory for Northumbrian arms. And it looks like Malcolm is, you know, he's a busted flush before he's even begun.
Angela Rayner would say that's just how we do things in the North.
Yes. So they're treated like scum.
Right. Yes.
These poor Scottish nobles. But Malcolm is... he's a survivor,
yeah.
And he's a canny player, and he retrenches, and he consolidates his power. And then in 1018, so kind of 15 years later, he invades again, and this time it's a smashing success. And this is the Battle of Carham, which effectively establishes the River Tweed as the border between what will become Scotland and England.
Right.
And the English lands of Lothian, which had been part of Northumbria, become a part of Scotland, and so this is all kind of happening on. Now, Malcolm wants to nail down his son has died, but his grandson is a guy called Duncan.
We all know Duncan,
And Duncan in turn has two sons, Malcolm and Donalbane.
Okay, yes, this is all very familiar.
So Malcolm wants to nail down Duncan as his heir, despite the fact that there are kind of alternative candidates.
Yeah.
And one of those candidates is the King of Moray, who is called Macbeth.
Finally.
Okay.
So how old is Macbeth at this point?
Malcolm dies in 1034.
Mm-hmm.
So Macbeth, he's probably born around 1000. He's in his mid-30s. And he is... So his grandfather was called Rory.
All right.
Rory. Okay.
So is his grandfather Irish? Or Gaelic?
Gaelic,
yeah.
Yeah, because they're all starting to speak Gaelic by this point. Yeah. His father is called Finlay. He's a rather ineffectual guy who is, you know, he wants to, you know, he has ambitions to become more powerful than he is as King of Moray, but he's a bit ineffectual.
Right.
He gets murdered by his nephews, so Macbeth's cousins. Macbeth has to flee, probably to Ireland.
Okay.
Macbeth comes back. By this time, the elder of his cousins has died, but there's the younger one, a guy called Gilla Comgain. So not Malcolm, Kenneth. So this is an exciting development. Yeah. He gets burnt to death. We don't know whether it's Macbeth who does it, but perhaps it was.
Okay.
You know, I mean, Macbeth stands to benefit. And then Macbeth marries... Macbeth marries a woman who is a descendant of Kenneth MacAlpine from the opposite line from the one that Malcolm II has come from.
So that gives him a bit of a claim, right?
It does. So he's now secure on the throne of Moray.
Yeah.
And he's married this woman who becomes Lady Macbeth. And do you know her name?
Sheila.
Gruok.
Gruok. Okay, that was unexpected.
Gruok. And she has a son, Lulac.
So what language is this?
This is Gaelic.
Okay, that's Gaelic as well.
So there's always, from the play, there's always this famous question, how many children did Lady Macbeth have?
Yeah, yeah.
Because she describes having babies, but then she says she has no, you know...
Yes.
They have no children.
Yeah.
But actually they have one. They have this
Lulac.
Lady Macbeth does. So this becomes Macbeth's foster son. So Macbeth is an obvious candidate for those who are opposed to Duncan.
Yeah.
And Duncan, unlike in Shakespeare's play, is not a kind of wise old guy with a long white beard. He's a rather rash, hot-tempered guy, again, in his mid-30s, same age pretty much as Macbeth. And he decides that he's going to launch a preemptive strike against Macbeth because he can see that Macbeth is consolidating his power in Moray. Duncan doesn't really want a bit of this. So he invades.
Mm-hmm.
Macbeth goes out to meet him, kills Duncan in battle. And so Macbeth is then the only candidate to become king and becomes king.
So Macbeth has been very hard done by at this, judging so far. I mean, he hasn't behaved badly at all.
Well, apart from burning his uncle, his cousin to death, perhaps.
But we don't even context, that.
Yeah.
Against of that's, general that, bad behaviour, I would say.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's kind of very much par for course.
He doesn't. So he's not Richard III. He doesn't stand out to people at the time.
No, not at all.
As tyrannical, you know.
Absolutely not. No, not
so
at all.
So then he's not toppled straight away, is he?
No.
10 years or something?
No. He becomes king in 1040.
Yeah.
And Duncan's sons, Malcolm and Donalbain, flee, as they do in the play.
Yeah.
In the play, they go to England. Probably they go to Orkney, which is a kind of further complicating factor, because Orkney is Norse, is Viking.
Okay.
So that's a kind of further, you know,
let's not get into the Orkney game. Now.
Yeah. No, we won't. We won't. And Macbeth rules very, very successfully. And so, you know, I said he goes to Rome. So he and Gruok go to Rome. And they kind of issue charters, handing out their land and things before they go.
Yeah.
You know, this is the oldest named charter. This is the oldest charter naming a Queen of Scotland. It's Lady Macbeth. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. Knut had gone on pilgrimage to Rome.
Yeah.
And he could do that because he was a great and famous king, incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know, was going to challenge his authority while he was away. So the fact that Macbeth can do the same is a tribute to, you know, how firmly rooted.
There's no revolt or anything
like
that.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a kind of, basically, he's establishing an entire new dynasty,
you know,
the dynasty of Moray. Basically, the dynasty of Kenneth MacAlpine has been parked, and you could see that, you know, if they'd had children, if Lulac had in turn had his children, that this would set Scotland on a kind of completely new dynastic course.
Yeah.
However, that is not what happens.
Do we have time? Will you get through this before the break?
Yes, I will.
Go on then.
How much time have I got?
I don't know, you've got a few minutes.
Okay, this is very Rachel Morley.
So,
1054,
yeah.
The English invade again.
Oh, so it was the English, isn't it?
Well, it isn't always, because actually the English haven't been invading very much. So this is the first invasion since Athelstan's invasion about 100 years, over 100 years before.
Yeah.
And it's not entirely an English invasion, because by this point the Earl of Northumbria is a Scandinavian, Earl Seward.
Right, yes, yes.
And he's married Uhtred's granddaughter. And basically he's invading Scotland just for the fun of it, because he's a Scandinavian warlord and because he can. So he goes and he crosses the Firth of Forth up into the Highlands. Macbeth, it seems, was aiming for a hill fort called Dunsinane. But he doesn't fight there. He gets kind of cornered, and there's an incredibly brutal battle on the feast day of the Seven Sleepers of Ephesus. Who are Christians who went to sleep during the persecution and wake up a century later, and everything's great. So this is known as the Battle of the Seven Sleepers. Macbeth ends up losing, so he has to kind of flee. But Seward, it's bad for him too, because his son and heir dies in the battle, which again is kind of mentioned in the play.
Yes.
But unlike in the play, Macbeth is not finished. You know, he's able to kind of fight on, because he's kind of doing the classic guerrilla tactics of retreating up into the highlands that, you know, people have always done in Scotland. And the following year, Siward dies of dysentery, which is a kind of bad way for a Viking kind of warlord to go.
Occupational hazard when you're leading armies in medieval period.
But obviously Macbeth's prestige and the stability of his reign have been severely knocked.
Yeah.
And so he has, you know, this kind of threatening figure of Malcolm, the son of Duncan, hovering in the background, who's in alliance with the Norse of Orkney. And the Norse of Orkney attack in 1057, and Lulac is slain. Mm. Actually, by this point, Macbeth has retired and gone to a monastery. So Lulac is kind of ready to become king.
Yeah.
But gets killed, I think, treacherously. The implication is, and kind of, you know, he goes to negotiations and gets stabbed.
Yeah.
Kind of very Game of Thrones style.
Yeah.
So Macbeth comes out of retirement, meets with Malcolm, and is defeated, and Malcolm becomes king. But it, again, it's the measure of the respect in which Macbeth is held that, unlike in the play where, you know, Macbeth's body and that of Lady Macbeth are exposed to kind of be a wonder and a horror, mm-hmm. to the Scots, Macbeth is given a very honourable burial on the Isle of Iona, which is the traditional burial place for the kings of Scotland. So he's laid to rest there. But obviously his dynasty is finished, and the dynasty of Kenneth MacAlpine has returned to the throne. And this essentially establishes the kind of the myth that Kenneth MacAlpine was the undisputed founder of Scottish royalty, and that there is this continuous line that can be traced.
And that Macbeth is a usurper.
And therefore Macbeth, and this obviously becomes incredibly important during the 13th and 14th century in the war with England, when England is trying to annex the Scottish kingdom.
Yeah.
Because the kings of Scotland need to assert the fact that they have a kind of a lineage that is as straight and clear and distinguished as the English one.
Yeah.
And Macbeth simply doesn't fit into this story. So he has to be cast as a usurper.
Great. So Macbeth has lived and died. That was the real Macbeth. And now we'll take a break. And then the second half, the Three Witches, demonology, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
So we'll see you after the break.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest Is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator," I said, "you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
A drum, the rest is history. The second part doth come. That's terrible, isn't it? That's absolute
that's
shocker.
Great. That's great. I think you should do that every time.
Yes. So we're talking about Macbeth. In the first half, we've plunged into the absolute bog that is early medieval Scotland. And we've now dragged ourselves out of that bog.
Well, you were in that bog.
Yeah, I was in that bog. You were just kind of watching, yeah. Offering helpful questions and scoffing.
Just laughing.
Laughing. So basically, we've established the reason why Macbeth is kind of transformed into this figure of a usurper.
Yes.
By the 16th century, when Ralph Holinshed, the great chronicler, not just of England, but of Scotland and Ireland, is doing his chronicle, Macbeth, the story of Macbeth with the three weird sisters and Banquo and Macduff and all that kind of stuff, it's there as history.
Yes.
And Dominic, we have a question here from Barry Grogan. If James I of England, the 6th of Scotland, wasn't king, would Shakespeare have ever written Macbeth? It appears to be somewhat of a Scottish story for the newish Scottish king of England. So what is the context for Shakespeare deciding to pick up on this story that he's found in Holinshed's chronicle and running with it?
Well, I think, I don't know whether you'll disagree with this or not, but I think there's no possibility he would have written Macbeth had it not been for James becoming king. I mean, I suppose there's an outside possibility, but it's deliberately written for a new Stuart king. So to give the context here, Elizabeth I has died in 1603, and James VI of Scotland has become the first Scottish king to rule England as well. So there's this sort of, the Anglo-Scottish stuff is in the ether. There's a lot of anxiety. It's an incredibly paranoid time anyway, as everybody knows, you know, fears of plots and so on. Now, the gunpowder plot plays
Macbeth is written, comes out in 1606.
That's when we think it was first performed. So, and the gunpowder plot is yet another rabbit hole.
Okay, but the gunpowder plot is 1605.
Yes.
So it's absolutely written in the shadow of that.
So that's what we think. So basically, Shakespeare and his company, they end up becoming the king's men. They have the patronage of James, which obviously you want if you're a theatrical company. James believes that he is descended from Banquo. So Banquo is in the Holinshed Chronicles in 1577, but he's Macbeth's collaborator. So Shakespeare changes Banquo's character. So Banquo becomes the voice of virtue, you know, horrified by Macbeth's crimes, the ghost at the feast and all that stuff.
And Fleance, his son, escapes
exactly
to become the forefather of Mary Queen of Scots and James.
Precisely. So it's clearly flattering James in that sense. The gunpowder plot stuff is absolutely fascinating. So this is what helps us to date it, because Shakespearean historians have sort of, you know, it's all very unclear with Shakespeare when some plays were written, who wrote, you know, Shakespeare and a collaborator or what, and when they were performed. But we are pretty sure that this is written and performed after the gunpowder plot, because there is a whole scene in which the porter, who is there for comic relief, gives this speech in which he is mocking, basically, the speech that a Jesuit called Henry Garnet gave at his trial after the gunpowder plot. So Garnet relied upon a defence called equivocation. You'll know much more about me than...
Well, he writes a pamphlet about it, doesn't he? And
James' agency.
What is equivocation
agency.
Again? Remind me what it is. It's a doctrine of...
So equivocation, up until 1605, basically means something that's ambiguous.
Yeah.
So it's something that could be one thing or the other. But after this pamphlet is found, and Garnet is the... he's the kind of the Jesuit superior in England. So
yes.
He's top Jesuit. And... He was very against the gunpowder plot.
But he'd been told about it.
But he'd been told about like it under the law of confession.
He couldn't
reveal it. But he kind of writes to his superiors in Rome and says, please, do what you can, pull strings to try and stop this from going ahead. But it does go ahead. And so obviously he is absolutely in the firing line. So he gets arrested. And the agents who arrest him discover this pamphlet in which he's written about equivocation being justified. And the way that Garnet uses equivocation is basically that you say one thing meaning the other so that you won't get in trouble for Catholics. Yeah. So it's a way for Catholics to practice their faith without kind of drawing attention to themselves.
But this is incredibly controversial. Everybody mocks it and says this is
completely
terrible, Weasley
yes.
behaviour. Garnet...
And he gets executed.
Gets executed. And so we know, I think he's executed, or he uses the... equivocation defense, saying one thing and thinking another or whatever, in March 1606. And then the porter's speech in the play, the porter is mocking equivocation, I think, or talking about it.
Yeah, so faith, here's an equivocator that could swear exactly. in both the scales against either scale, who committed treason enough for God's sake, yet could not equivocate in heaven. So
basically, we think, gone. Everybody thinks, right, 1606, it must be done in reaction to that, because it's in the air.
Yeah.
But generally, obviously... You've had the gunpowder plot, the attempt to kill the king. Macbeth is a play about killing a king. So it's kind of there. Of course, it's in the context of there have been gazillions of plots against Elizabeth I and against James in Scotland and again in England. So it sort of feels very timely.
Yeah.
And of course, there's one other element, which we'll probably come to now.
We've got John Liddell. Is the role of witchcraft in Macbeth reflective of contemporaneous beliefs, or is a Shakespearean era addition? So I guess by that, is it something that comes from the 11th century?
Let's not go back to the 11th
but,
century.
But no, it's fine, Dominic, because
yeah.
it isn't. Because it's absolutely expressive of the witch craze, but specifically of James.
So James, such a strange thing. We talked about James I in this podcast before. A fancy for courtiers with long legs, tongue too big for his mouth, slobbering, wisest fool in Christendom, all of this stuff. But the weirdest thing about him, I think, is this obsession with witches. So he writes a thing called Demonology, 1597, where he talks about demons, vampires, werewolves, and witches above all. And you know why? I'm sure you do know. Because he believes he's been targeted by witches. So this really weird thing, he sailed over to Copenhagen to get Anne of Denmark, his wife. And it was very stormy. And when he got there, there was all these storms. And the Danes said, this is undoubtedly the work of witches. Because the Danes were obsessed with witches too. The great Trier witch trials in Germany were taking place. So the Danes had heard about this. They're very excited about witches. James, who's clearly a bit of a... James loves a conspiracy theory. And he's just interested in the occult and all this kind of stuff. He says, yes, I probably have been the target of witches. He gets back. And they have all these witch trials. The North Berwick witch trials. And he's trying to round up. Now, what's unclear is he really wants people to find that the third Earl of Bothwell is chief witch and is orchestrating this, because the Earl of Bothwell is his great enemy and has been plotting against him. So they're constantly kind of interrogating his women and saying, have you been consorting with the Earl of Bothwell and Satan and plotting against me? So all these women, lots of people are killed. It's a terrible story. And James writes at length in this book, Demonology. And in Demonology, it talks about the witch trials. So the really fascinating thing is that James is obviously completely obsessed with conspiracies and plots, understandably, because he's been the attempted target of them. He's obsessed with witches. And Shakespeare takes some of the stuff from James's own book and puts it in the play.
He does. But just to complicate the story somewhat, August 1605, so if Macbeth is written in 1606, kind of year before, there's plague in London.
Yeah.
So there's a lockdown. And James goes to Oxford to sit out the plague. And as he rides into Oxford, he's met by three young men dressed as nymphs.
Right.
And these three young men in Latin hail him, kind of along the lines of, you know, hail James, King of Scotland, hail James, King of Great Britain, and so on. And this is written by a guy called Matthew Gwynn, who's a kind of very scholarly playwright, who's taken it from Holinshed. And he's taken they're not called witches in Holinshed, the three women who hail Macbeth.
That's interesting.
So they're called, I think, weird women, that kind of thing. And so people have obviously kind of thought, well, you know, is this an influence? And almost certainly, it seems impossible that it wasn't. Shakespeare might.
How would Shakespeare know about it?
Well, so he's not in London at the time, so maybe he was in Oxford as well. We don't know. I mean, you know, he's King's Men, or maybe he heard about it.
This moment with the three nymphs, has this been scripted and it's kind of a big public.
Yeah, so it's a big kind of public.
So Shakespeare could have been.
So he could have watched it. I mean, I think the consensus is that he wasn't there, but he would obviously have heard about it. And if he's researching Macbeth, then definitely he would have heard about it.
And if he'd seen that James loved this.
Yes.
Then he'd think.
But obviously, the three weird sisters are much more menacing and dangerous. Well, they're equivocal.
Yeah.
I mean, they equivocate. You know, Macbeth talks about the equivocating fiend.
Mm.
And I think that one of the things that also reflects the gunpowder plot is the sense that people in Protestant England absolutely have was that this was the work of the devil. And that therefore kind of the process of plotting against a king, you know, it must come from kind of, you know, the evil of human nature, which is Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. But it also somehow comes from a kind of darkness that is more hellish and more infernal than just human nature. And that's kind of, I mean, that's the essence of the play, isn't it? It's the fusion of personal evil and a kind of supernatural darkness.
But is it kind of personal evil, though? You know, Shakespeare was writing this at about the same time, I mean, give or take a year, as Antony and Cleopatra. And there's a similar kind of, you know, Antony and Cleopatra gets a lot of that from Plutarch. There's a kind of nobility to Antony and Cleopatra that is undone tragically. Their ambition leads them astray and stuff. There's a bit of that in Macbeth and Lady Macbeth.
Yeah,
they're not pure evil.
They're not. But that's the tragedy, isn't it? That Macbeth is a kind of great man who's won a great battle and who is given, you know, all kinds of titles. And Lady Macbeth is clearly a kind of very powerful figure.
Yeah.
Great hostess.
Yes, right. Well,
brilliant. Clams. What could be more fun than staying there? But they take this step, and from that point on, it's downward. I mean, that's the essence of the tragedy.
What is fascinating, actually, Macbeth is very short. So Macbeth is about half as long as Hamlet, I think. And some Shakespearean scholars say, you know, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth leap by Shakespearean standards very quickly from thought to deed, and their motivation is not always entirely clear. And some Shakespearean scholars think that the text that we have is a fragment of the original Macbeth, and that what we have basically is a prompt script. So a script that was sort of hanging around for the actors, but is not the definitive, I mean, as insofar as Shakespeare ever did definitive texts, but there is a bigger Macbeth, there is a kind of Macbeth, in which the characters of Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are more fleshed out.
People doing GCSE English. Must be quite relieved.
They must be, yes, I suppose that's true.
But, of course, I mean, you know, whether that's true or not, it's a play that becomes so famous.
You know who's a big fan of Macbeth?
Who?
Samuel Pepys.
I didn't know that.
Pepys, in his diaries, goes to see it, I think he goes about a dozen times. He'll often just say, you know...
So I wonder what the...
I went again to see Macbeth, brilliant, loved it.
What do you think the appeal was?
Well, what is the appeal of Macbeth? I mean, the appeal of Macbeth is it's very action-heavy for a Shakespearean play.
I think the supernatural is absolutely supernatural, part of it.
The idea of killing a king is obviously fascinating, particularly... I mean, we live in an age of... You know, we live in an age of assassinations anyway, as did they.
Yes.
The idea of killing
a king... Well, so they don't show the death of Duncan on stage.
Yeah.
Which is unusual. And may well, reflect sensitivities.
Yes,
showing a Scottish king being murdered on stage.
I'm sure.
Not a good thing.
I mean, you think about James the Sixth of Scotland, and the experience of his mother. I mean, his mother executed.
Okay, so we've got a question here from SO3 Clausewitz, friend of the show. To what extent has Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth coloured subsequent perceptions of ambitious and powerful women? What, if any, impact did this portrayal have on the attitudes of contemporary audiences to their recently Tudor queens, Mary and Elizabeth? I don't know the answer to that. I'd have thought that would Shakespeare would have been straying into dangerous waters there, but I guess there's a kind of...
The idea of the powerful woman, obviously, is on people's minds in a way that it wouldn't have been 100 years earlier, yeah. right? I mean, Henry VIII broke with Rome because he believed no woman could rule England unchallenged. Then two women do, and then the great other glamorous kind of heroine of the second half of the 16th century, Mary Queen of Scots, is James's mother, and she's involved in a billion plots, and she's executed. So it kind of makes sense that it's in the ether as a character.
It's an incredibly political play.
Yeah, it's a very political play. And I do think the Lady Macbeth, and I mean, the obvious model for her, I think, is Cleopatra. The mm-hmm. idea that the Romans had of the sort of demonic, monstrous fit woman, crazed with ambition, who drives
who lures the noble man.
Yeah, this noble general, but who's got one fatal flaw: he's weak, and he's basically, you know, he's henpecked, and drags him down. And what's interesting is that archetype has endured ever since. So Lady Macbeth, you know, Hillary Clinton was a Lady Macbeth figure for Bill Clinton, people said in the 1990s.
Cherie Blair.
And now, you know, I've seen it, you know, lots of times. Boris Johnson's wife now, Carrie, is described as Lady Macbeth, the power behind the throne. She got him to sack Sajid Javid as Chancellor, all this kind of thing. I mean, this is the classic thing that political women have to endure. That they, if you know, it's that they're working behind the scenes in this conspiratorial kind of spider's web way.
Yes. So you mentioned the bust up. In New York.
Yes.
Are there other... But you also, at the top of the show, said that you were going to unleash...
I was. I've got other performances of Macbeth at my sleeve.
Okay, so what have you got for us?
So if I was going to go back and see one production of Macbeth, it would be the so-called Voodoo Macbeth. Do you know the Voodoo Macbeth?
No.
So this was done by Orson Welles in 1936. I mean, Orson Welles, as many listeners will know, was sort of making great films and plays when he was about four. And he was 20, I think, when he made this.
So is this before or after the War of the Worlds on the radio that
That's
gets
a good
everyone...
question. I think it might actually be before. I think it's a couple of years before. And it's part of the Federal Theatre Project, which is this big kind of New Deal kind of social democratic programme. And he does it in Harlem. He puts on a production of Macbeth in Harlem. And he says he wants to set it in Haiti. So Macbeth is a kind of slave king who's taken power. He has a black cast, 150 people.
So is Duncan white?
No, they're all black.
They're all black.
And at first, the local Communist Party, very big in Harlem, and protests against it and says, no, he's exploiting black labour. He's going to show black people in a bad light, and it's sort of making fun of black people. But actually, after the first night, it's a tremendous success. And you can see online, listeners can look it up, amazing photos of Harlem basically gridlocked, people desperate to get into this.
God, how brilliant to have that when you're 20. A 20-year-old director.
It's landmark play, the Voodoo Macbeth. I mean, obviously, he probably couldn't really do it now. He'd be cancelled for some. But, that's a... And there's also another 1930s sort of related Macbeth production, which is interesting. So Dmitri Shostakovich's opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk. So there's a 19th century novel taking the Macbeth story and setting it in kind of Russia. This opera, which Shostakovich regards as a great work, this is the work that Stalin goes to see, and he doesn't like it because he doesn't like its avant-garde music. And he walks out
with
white face. So
he's a massive conservative.
He is a massive... Well, artistically, Stalin's incredibly conservative, but also Stalin likes kind of Shakespeare, and he likes, you know, this kind of stuff. So he's appalled by Shostakovich's opera. And afterwards, Pravda condemns Shostakovich. Shostakovich is in fear
for writing modernist rubbish.
Modernist rubbish. And Shostakovich then goes back and ends up writing, I think it's his Fifth Symphony, much more kind of traditional music that Stalin likes.
Mm.
So that's another interesting production. Now, I had one more Macbeth story, actually, on my sleeve. So about 20-odd years ago, I once did a play at the Edinburgh Festival.
Did you?
About... it was Jean-Anouilh's play Becket, about Thomas Becket.
Having heard the way you read night, and what people don't know is that it took Dominic about 10 goes to do that, because he kept corpsing.
Yeah, I did. Or I was doing it in various Scottish accents.
Yes.
So I played Becket in this play, got, I think, 2 stars, and The Scotsman out of 5.
okay.
And once we'd done it, sort of student play. We never spoke of it again. But then many years later, I got a random phone call when I was about to start doing my PhD, and it was the director of this play. And he said, I am about to take a production to America of Macbeth. And we've got stilt walkers. It's a huge thing. We've got lots of money. And one of the actors has dropped out at the last minute. And basically, I'm utterly desperate. We're leaving on Monday. We'll be gone for 6 months touring America. Could you join the production? And I said, well, who would I be playing? And he said, Macbeth.
Oh, Dominic.
And I didn't do it. Now,
you
here's the thing.
It down.
Now, here's the thing. That man went on to direct Paddington and Paddington 2.
Oh, Dominic.
So if I'd only played my cards right, I would have been Paddington and you'd be doing this with Ben Whishaw.
Hollywood's Dominic Sandbrook.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, having heard you read, do you want to just do it with a Scottish accent? Because it's...
my so Scottish good. Accent is shocking.
No, but go on.
What rhubarb, senna, or what purgative drug will scour these English hens?
Well, so that, I think, leads us very neatly to the idea that Macbeth is a cursed play. So we've got had loads of questions about that. So Julian Lennox, speaking for many, many others, what is the story behind the play being cursed? Julian's mum is an actress and only refers to it as La Escoceza. She's Chilean and right. spits and knocks on wood if you say its name.
But don't people walk around a theatre and they turn around three times and
something
have
like
to
that.
Say, have to yeah. swear or something?
Something like that. Yeah.
So I read online and doing my intensive research that this is because provincial plays used to put on Macbeth when they're running out of money.
That's what it says in Wikipedia.
Yeah. Not true, according to you.
Well, so I'm drawing on James Shapiro.
Okay, he's probably a more authoritative source.
Who I think must have written about the bust up in New York, because he wrote a whole book about yeah. American reactions yes. to Shakespeare, which I haven't read. But I have read his book on 1606, the year of King
yeah.
Lear,
yeah.
which is also the year of Macbeth. And he writes loads about Macbeth. So I checked it, and he says that the origins of this curse is as late as it's the end of the 19th century. And it originates with Max Beerbohm,
oh, yes.
who's writing a review of a play. And he, just for fun, he makes up a story that he attributes to John Aubrey, the 17th century
Brief Lives
guy who actually lived in Broadshaw, the village where I grew up. So we're very proud of him. Anyway, so he fabricates a story which he attributes to John Aubrey, that the boy who was playing Lady Macbeth gets sick.
Yeah.
And so Shakespeare himself has to step in to play Lady Macbeth. And obviously Shakespeare has a beard, you know, he's bald.
he's unconvincing.
He's unconvincing. So this is the origins of the curse.
Well, that's it. That's not much of a curse.
Yes. It's that's where that's where the story begins from. But obviously, he's going with the grain of the fact that there are all these witches and devils and
quoting
smoke of thunder.
James Shapiro's version. The version that I read came from Sir Donald Sindon.
Yeah, so well, I'd back...
You'd back you'd
James
back
Shapiro with Sir Donald Sindon anytime. So I reckon that's it. And I reckon we've done Macbeth now, haven't we?
We have. I think that world of Scottish politics in the Middle Ages... I mean, you're welcome to return to it at your leisure.
It is interesting, though, don't you think?
I think it is interesting.
About how nations... Because Scottish identity now is, it's a massive political fact that is,
yes.
The whole future of the United Kingdom. And the fact that it kind of, the idea of Scotland begins in such a... kind of complex, tortuous, twisted way. And it's exactly the same with English identity.
Yeah,
of course it is.
Of all national identities.
I think that Scottish identity is kind of weaker than English identity for quite a while. And it's really it's the English invasions that really consolidates it and kind of prompts the construction of this backstory, which basically shunts poor Macbeth to one side.
Yes, it's weird, isn't it? The Macbeth is probably the single best known. Do you think it's the best known or a sort of artistic depiction of Scottishness over the centuries?
It's certainly the most famous depiction of a Scottish king, isn't it?
Yeah. Other than Braveheart, which I know you're...
I think it's more famous than Braveheart.
Yeah, even. Let's hope so anyway.
Anyway, we I think that's enough Macbethery.
It is.
So we will we'll say goodbye. What are we doing next? I can't remember. Oh, we've got Mary Beard talking about classics.
Yes, very exciting.
Coming on Thursday.
Yeah.
So we will see you then.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.